Pete Stevens. He's a civil servant responsible for various aspects of trade negotiations at the DTI. He's also himself worked in community development in Malawi. My name's Rosie Aykroyd. I'm from Greenbelt Management Committee, and I'm going to be putting some questions to Pete before we take some questions from the floor. Better just declare an interest. Until a week ago, I was a colleague of Pete's at the DTI, but as of Friday, I can ask him whatever I want. Pete's actually going to be taking part in a panel debate this afternoon later on with The Economist, Christian Aid and various others, so I expect we'll get into some pretty meaty stuff there. So I think, first of all, this afternoon, we'll probably just look at some of the tensions that Pete grapples with in his job and then see where the discussion goes. First of all, Pete, I wonder if you can tell us a bit about your role at the DTI and perhaps a bit about the run-up to Gleneagles and your involvement with that.
Okay, I cover trade negotiations with the developing world, so I cover something like 130 countries or so, negotiating trade agreements with them to give them access to the European market. And late last year, I was involved in the run-up to Gleneagles and really trying to identify what did we want to get out of the Gleneagles summit, particularly for Africa, and also looking at trade issues and looking at a variety of things, just being aware also that 2005 is a key year. In December, we have the major trade summit in Hong Kong, where a lot of decisions, hopefully, are going to be taken that will move the whole trade negotiations forward. So it's a key year. It's been a very exciting year and a very challenging year, but there's a lot going on, I guess.
Okay. In terms of Gleneagles, there was a lot of high expectations, but in terms of actual delivery, should we be happy with what was achieved or not?
Gleneagles delivered a lot on the aid front. On the trade side, it didn't deliver as much as we would have wanted. I think there's a recognition that a lot of it's going to actually, the key event's going to be Hong Kong in December. But on the other hand, you had an opportunity with eight of the key players to try and broker some sort of progress towards Hong Kong in December. And unfortunately, it didn't get as far as we might have hoped it would have got.
That means it doesn't bode well for December, surely. If we can't get eight countries to agree in July, how are we going to manage it in December?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at work in the department, I'm a bit of the sceptic and a bit of the pessimist. I think they view me as a Jeremiah. But I think we should start to get very concerned about what progress might be made at Hong Kong. I think there is a real risk that the trade negotiations will break down in December. And if the trade negotiations break down, a lot of the progress that we've seen in terms of export subsidies, in terms of increasing access, particularly for African countries and least developed countries, could well be lost. So I think we have reason to be very concerned. And obviously, we're doing a lot on the political front to try and move things forward and try and broker a deal. But I think, to throw it back to you guys, I think that there is a challenge actually for Christians to pray and see something happen, because at the moment, humanly, it looks like we're heading towards disaster. So,
how far is the UK government able to really broker any leverage in these talks? Obviously, at the moment, we've got the presidency of the EU, we've got the presidency of the G8. In practice, what difference does that make? Are we still just one player amongst 130?
It's a bit like being a captain of a football team. I mean, you have a role in terms of organising things, but at the end of the day, you can't boss people around. And I think the UK is kind of... We're a bit... We have a very clear position. And I think there's a certain sense within Europe that when the UK opens its mouth, or maybe the Dutch also open their mouth because they're also very outspoken, there are some people who view, oh, here we go again, and they can kind of predict what we're going to say. Now, that doesn't mean we back off. But I think the environment in Europe has got a lot harder. I don't know if you've been following the news recently about bra wars, kind of the latest stage in terms of trade negotiations, and there is I think quite a strong backlash now within Europe from what was a very positive push towards a more pro-development outcome. I think there's now started to be a backlash in the opposite direction that's saying, well, actually, we've got our own industries that we should protect. And I think it's starting to make it a lot harder. I think the political consensus that there was within Europe around trade actually is now starting to fragment, with one group of countries on a very pro-development track and others on a much more I have to be diplomatic about how I put this, a much more protectionist and a much more steady-as-it-goes track. So I think we're starting to get a little concerned that it gets very difficult to then take a position, because if you're in negotiations and you don't know whether you've got the support of the rest of Europe, it makes it very difficult then to negotiate.
And how in practice does that affect you in your day-to-day role in terms of actually trying to get some sense of job satisfaction and some sense that you're actually making a difference?
It depends if you enjoy the game. I mean, if anyone's played the game of Risk and the sort of the alliances, there's an element of that. A lot of the negotiations I was involved in earlier on this year was about trying to increase access into the European Union, particularly for some Southern Asian countries. And you were counting up the votes of how many are for us, how many are against of us. You know, we've got 142 votes against us, we've got 119 votes for us, we've got to keep the Estonians on board, we need to try and get the Lithuanians on side as well. It's frustrating, particularly when sometimes you don't know what might happen that will unravel that.
I know, Pete, in particular, you're responsible for UK policy on economic partnership agreements, which the EU's negotiating at the moment with African, Caribbean and Pacific countries. Now, the Make Poverty History campaign has accused the EU of basically trying to use these negotiations to force these countries to open up before they're ready. The UK put out a statement, didn't we, earlier this year about where we stood on the EC mandate, negotiating mandate. It's fair to say our position is actually closer to Make Poverty Histories than to the EU's, isn't it?
I think in many ways. I mean, we've worked very closely with Make Poverty History, and we have a lively discussion. We don't always agree. But we have tried to take on board some of the points that they've made. I think the challenge that we face is that we then need to convince the rest of Europe about this. And I think the concern we've had is if you look at what's going to really impact Africa, it's not going to be so much the WTO negotiations, because in some ways Africa isn't going to be particularly affected by that. What's really going to affect Africa are these agreements that are being negotiated bilaterally between Europe and the African, Caribbean and Pacific countries. They're what's really going to matter. And over the last couple of years, it's been very difficult to get anyone to take any interest in them. It's almost like not being invited to a party. There's a party going on, and everyone's focusing about the WTO and all the issues around there. And then actually there are these really important trade negotiations that no one has been focusing on. I think one thing that Make Poverty History campaign has managed to do is raise the profile of those, so suddenly people are starting to take an interest in them. But it's still a few of the typical countries who would have an interest who are following these negotiations, and the bulk of Europe isn't interested, which is a challenge.
How much clear blue water is there between the UK government position on trade and Make Poverty Histories? Is it really as black and white as the campaigners make out?
I think in terms of the objectives of what we're trying to do, I don't think there is a difference. I think it's how you get there that's the challenge. And I think that's where there are greater disagreements. And in some ways, I think it's a bit like the Christian faith. Because it's easy to make statements like love your neighbour. It's really difficult on a Monday morning when someone's really teeing you off to actually put that into practice. And I think that's the challenge that we find, or certainly I find as a Christian involved in these negotiations and trying to deliver a pro-development outcome, is that it's the how that's really difficult. We might know what we want to do, but it's how you get there. And Make Poverty History campaign, in some ways, doesn't have to grapple with the ins and outs of the how. And they provide almost a prophetic role in terms of saying, this is what you should be doing. But the reality is it's really challenging and really difficult. And so there's some very thorny issues in how you get there.
So in practice, do you find the interventions by campaigners helpful? Because you're having to deal with the intricacies of trying to get many different countries to agree. Obviously, the campaigners can just deal with the idealism of the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think broadly speaking, it's been very positive. I think certainly within the UK government, the negotiations I've been dealing with Africa were just not on the radar 2 years ago. When I first started looking at these negotiations, there was no interest at all. Now I think we would say it's our second trade priority after the WTO. So in terms of creating support and pushing that has been very welcome. I think in terms of generally raising the issue and raising the agenda, I think within the UK it's been very effective. the observation I'd make is across Europe, civil society, NGOs, aren't as active in other countries, which means that actually, in some ways, all the pressure has been on the UK government, and other countries haven't had the same push. And I think that's an area where things could change. I do have one note of caution. I've had long arguments with Make Poverty History Campaign over this, which is, to what extent has Make Poverty History Campaign raised expectations amongst the general public, and what will happen on the 1st of January 2006? I'm old enough to remember Band-Aid, and there was a sense after Band-Aid, well, that's fine, we've solved all the problems of Ethiopia. We hadn't. In the same way, in the run-up to the millennium, there was the Jubilee Debt Campaign. We thought, great, this is going to solve all the problems around debt. It hasn't. And my real fear is that the issues around trade, the issues around development, are really complex. And from a campaigning point of view, you have to simplify the message and make it black and white and make there some good guys and some bad guys. It's not that easy. It's really complex. If it was that easy, we'd have solved it 20 years ago. It's not that easy. And my fear is that people will forget about the issues around Africa once 2005 is over and Make Poverty History Campaign moves on or the focus moves on, and actually the issues will still be there. And what I don't want to see is in 5-10 years' time, we have to come back again, not least because I don't think I could cope with Bob Geldof running Live 8 for a third time. I think there is a real issue that we need to keep the focus on these issues. And I think the challenge is, that, again, throwing it back to you guys, as people who are involved in Make Poverty History Campaign, will you remember this post 2005, when the focus is off, will you continue to be engaged? Will you continue to make sure that the cause and the voice of the poor continues to be heard in the corridors of power? That's the challenge. And my fear is that Make Poverty History Campaign could actually be a step backwards if people think, well, now we've done it, we solved it, we don't need to worry about it anymore.
Would you also feel that perhaps the target of the campaign has got to be at the EU as a whole rather than just the UK? Because to some extent, the EU position seems to be more aggressive than the UK's. So is it a case of bombarding Peter Mandelson with emails rather than Alan Johnson?
I had this discussion with a trade justice movement that suggested they might want to get their French partners in particular. Since we seem to have a regular joust, you know, Agincourt, and ever since we seem to be jousting, and particularly on trade policy, we joust on trade quite a lot, and suggest their French counterparts may like to bring some pressure to bear on the French government. And their point was actually the trade justice movement and Make Poverty History exist to put pressure on the UK government, which I think is a fair point. I mean, they're right in one point. They do exist to work on the UK government. I think the challenge we face is we are one voice amongst 25. And actually, if there isn't the wider constituency of support amongst Europe, there's very little that we can actually do. And I think that's a concern. From a political point of view, we're trying to build links to support our position. So I was in The Hague last week speaking to the Dutch government, and their NGOs have been active, and actually the Dutch government now, to a certain extent, is on the back foot because they've got guys like us coming to say, come on, get on board, and they've got their own Oxfam Netherlands and some other organisations who are putting them under pressure. But in other European countries, they don't have that. I think the other thing to say is Europe has fundamentally changed in the last year or so. Last May, we went from an EU of 15 to an EU of 25. The EU of 15 had a lot of links, particularly with Africa. I mean, if you look at the history, the colonial history, it's not exactly a great story of enlightened behaviour, but there are at least links between old Europe, if you like, and developing countries. If you look at the Europe now of 25, there's much more of a focus towards Russia and to the east, and the same sense of moral responsibility is not there in the same degree. So the whole environment within Europe has changed, and it's made it more of a challenge to us to persuade, you know, countries like Hungary and Poland, who are facing real challenges of their own, that they should care about other countries, some of whom they think are almost as wealthy as they are.
Just looking at your own personal perspective, you've obviously got presumably your own views on how to make poverty history, no doubt informed partly by your time spent in Malawi. How far are you able to put aside your own personal perspectives when you're actually working on behalf of the government, having to stick with government policy?
That's a good question. I mean, it comes down to yes, minister, almost, and the relationship that there is between officials and ministers. And I have to mind what I say, because I did spot one of my ministers wandering around the crowd today, so I have to be careful what I say. And, of course, ultimately it is ministers that decide policy. I think for me, the way it's affected me is the stuff that I do is at a really high level. You know, you're talking about blocks of 20, 30 countries. And it's kind of a rarefied legal and economic environment, and you start talking about gross domestic product and all this kind of stuff. And I think at the back of my mind were some of the people who I knew in Malawi and what it means for them, some of the communities we worked in. And for these guys, you know, their nearest market is a day's bicycle ride away. The thought of exporting to the European Union is just poles apart. And I think that's the real challenge. And I think that's something I know that we're going to touch on this afternoon, which is actually, it's fine to talk about poor countries, but actually you have to talk about poor people in poor countries and actually disadvantaged groups. And one of the concerns is, to what extent does the political elite in some developing countries, to what extent do they represent their communities, and to what extent are they accountable to their communities? And that comes onto the whole governance agenda. But I think there is a concern. Unless we actually make a difference for your small subsistence farmer who is growing maize on 2 acres of ground in Malawi and just grows a little bit of groundnuts or tomatoes as a cash crop, unless you can actually do something that will have an impact on them, then we're not going to be addressing actually our objective of alleviating poverty and making poverty history.
And when you were there, what struck you as the most pressing problems? Is it a case of unfair trade rules, or is it a case of just simply they need the infrastructure? Is it a case of they don't have the political government, the right political government in place? What are the actual problems that you found actually with communities in Malawi?
I mean, I think it's off the fundamental the particular issue we're talking about, trade. I mean, the most fundamental thing I noticed was just the impact of AIDS, HIV. I'm just taking the audience here. If you were in Malawi, half of you would die from AIDS before you reach 30. That's the reality. And the impact that is having on. They can't train teachers fast enough to keep up with AIDS, HIV. They can't train nurses fast enough to make up for HIV. And the impact that then has on communities, when the guys who work the fields, the men and women who work the fields, who tend to be younger, they die from AIDS, HIV. You have something like in Malawi, I know it's about 15% of families are female-headed, or are grandparents looking after grandkids because the parents have died. And that's having a huge impact on their ability actually to grow their economy. You know, there's just no growth going on. And I think of my time in Malawi, it was a bit like sticking a Band-Aid on an amputation. You know, the best that we could say is it's not getting any worse. And I think just the impact of AIDS, HIV is phenomenal. And that you have to kind of then fit into the trade debate, where it is all about infrastructure. You know, can you afford to get on your bike and take your tomatoes out, you know, down a day down to sell it to market? If they wanted to sell anything out of Africa, there's only one port in Africa that can export to the United States, and that's Durban in South Africa. So everything has to go down Africa to Durban to then be shipped out. And there's just no tar roads. I mean, in Malawi, one time, sorry, I'm gabbling here, but we wanted to go and visit friends in Tanzania. So we got in the truck and started driving. And about 100 miles before the Tanzanian border, and these guys are in a trade pact together and they're trying to establish a common market. About 100 miles before we got to the Tanzanian border, the tarmac road ran out. And you just sort of think, this is the reality. You know, they just cannot get stuff to market. So trade rules for a lot of these guys are a complete irrelevance, because actually they can't even trade amongst themselves. They haven't got the infrastructure to trade amongst themselves, let alone trying to get stuff over to Europe. Now, that doesn't mean that lets us off the hook not to do something about trade rules, but just the reality is there are bigger issues to make an impact on the poor.
Knowing what you know about Malawi and also how you describe yourself as a pessimist, do you feel quite disillusioned about what you feel can actually be achieved for development this year? I mean, what's your own personal take on how far further on we will be by the end of this year than we started up, you know, back in January?
I don't know. I mean, I am pessimistic about Hong Kong and the talks in December. I'm really not sure whether we're going to get anything beyond that. I think, having said that, what I would say the success of 2005 has been is actually putting Africa on the agenda. Given that we are in the midst of the war on terror and just the wider political things that are going on, to have Africa on the agenda is great. And just the fact that there is a profile that is there, I think, has really helped. And in terms of my work, it's made it a lot easier that I don't have to go and explain why we care about Africa. I can just get to grips with the issues. Having said that, unless we actually get any progress, it's fine talking about it, but unless we get any progress. And I think, I mean, over it all, as I look back on the experience of working community development in Africa, I said it was a bit like putting a Band-Aid on an amputation. And what we're trying to do at the moment in the trade talks, I think I fundamentally believe that humanly we do not have the answers for Africa. We do not have the answers for poverty. We cannot humanly do it. Now, that's not to get pessimistic and say we don't try. I think it's very much, if you look at the Christian faith, it's all about a mustard seed effect. And actually it's about planting a mustard seed and then saying, God, will you add the increase? And I guess what I look at in terms of international development and in terms of trade is about we have to do what we can do humanly. And there's a real pragmatism in the Bible. There's a verse in Ecclesiastes that says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. And there is a sense that you focus on what you can do. But I think fundamentally, humanly, we cannot solve the problems ourselves. We have to do what we can and then say, Lord, will you do something? Will you move? God of the nations, God of creation, God of justice, will you do something? Will you take our humble efforts and bring about the lasting change that we want to see?
Do you think your skills are better used as a civil servant for all the frustrations that has than within an NGO like Christian Aid?
I have to say, yes, Minister, is fairly true, and I'm a megalomaniac. And so from my point of view, I love having a degree of power. Not as much as I'd like, because I have to get the rest of Europe to agree, but I really enjoy the power and the chance to make a difference. I think more widely, I mean, I've been fortunate. I've worked overseas as a missionary in international development. I've worked as a church leader, and now I've gone from the ministry into the ministry. And I think for myself, it's really about the gifts and abilities that you're given. And if I'm honest, I was a fairly mediocre church leader. I was fairly average. But I seem to be quite good at the skullduggery and the chicanery of politics. And I enjoy it. And I think it's about, there is a sense of ministry and a sense of vocation in that. And I think for all of us, it's very easy to look at kind of vocation and think top of the pile is full-time Christian ministry or missionary work or whatever and have that view. And it's much more actually about thinking, what was I made to do? What are my skills and what are my abilities? And for me, I feel, at least for the time being, I am following the call of God and this is my vocation.
And do you feel that perhaps one day further on, taking a much more explicitly political role as an MP could actually mean that you can actually achieve far more? Or do you think as a civil servant you have more ability to influence?
There aren't any MPs in the audience, are there? Just checking. I mean, I had the opportunity to stand as an MP, and I decided not to, partly because I felt actually, in terms of my gifts and the position that I'm in, I probably can have more influence on the agendas that I care about. And that actually, I really do feel there's a sense of calling in this. I do feel, and just in terms of the circumstances, that I got this job, having just come out of full-time ministry. I was then interviewed by someone who was a Christian who had also recently come out of full-time Christian ministry to go and work in the government. Just in terms of the way I see it, this is very much what God's got for me. I love the political environment. I love the politics and dealing with that. But I think for myself, in terms of my skills, this is where I can have the greatest influence and hopefully do the most in terms of furthering the kingdom of God.
Okay, let's open it up to questions from the audience. We're going to use this as a roving mic. So,
any questions? One question. Do you enjoy the TV programme West Wing? And following on from that, you haven't mentioned anything about America and trade. You talked quite a lot about Europe and Africa. Any comments on American role in all of this?
Yeah. I love the West Wing. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a junkie. I think my wife despairs of me when I go and buy three newspapers on a Sunday and kind of watch the West Wing and these really boring programs on telly. But yeah, I mean, I think that there is something about the West Wing paints a sort of a hill environment that we don't have in quite the same way. But if you talk to most civil servants or most people involved in kind of Whitehall and Westminster, there is an element whereby you do get hooked on this kind of thing. And there is an there is a world sort of centred around Number 10 and centred around the West Wing that in some ways we as civil servants don't get involved in terms of spin doctors and that kind of side of things that we don't see, but that's interesting. The US, again, don't quote me as diplomatic. I mean, my personal view is that in some ways at the moment it is quite unhelpful. I don't think at the moment they're necessarily the major issue that we have. I mean, I guess from our point of view, we do trade negotiations as part of Europe, and actually we have enough problems trying to get Europe on side without even looking further as to the US. I think, however, I am very concerned. Just in the last week, you had John Bolton, who's the new US ambassador to the UN. Interesting move, you know, appoint someone as your UN ambassador who doesn't believe in the UN. I mean, it kind of says something about US foreign policy. And I've been working on something called the Ping Text, which is the General Assembly is having a meeting. It's going to be the largest meeting of world leaders ever in September for the Millennium Review Summit, reviewing the Millennium Goals and progress towards it. And the US in the past week has said, we want to drop all references in this Ping Text to the Millennium Goals. And you're just sat there thinking, you just want to gut this and turn this into a justification for macho foreign policy and the fight against terror and the need for international security. Now, those are important issues, but actually all of this was set up to try and make sure that the international community delivers on its commitments to international development. And then you sort of come and say, well, that doesn't matter. We want to push a different agenda. I struggle with that. I mean, in some areas, we have a positive relationship with the US. On other areas, it's really difficult.
Thanks very much, Jonathan Glennie, Christian Aid, just so I make myself known. Really, really enjoyed your presentation. Thanks very much. We very much appreciate that the UK government is one of the big governments pushing in the EU, and it is the other EU governments, especially in the US, that need to be dealt with. Just on the issue of, you said Make Poverty History has got to consider what happened in 2006 and the danger of letting it slip off the agenda. I would just, before I ask a question, I would say on that issue, I think we're very well aware of that. It's very, very difficult to keep this issue high on the, especially media agenda, because, you know, they're very fickle. And we are trying to do that. What we found at the G8 was that the politicians were trying very much to give the impression that masses had been done. And our message was, actually, thanks, a lot has been done, but a lot is left to do. And actually it was the politicians, including people like Blair and Brown's advisors, that were putting great pressure on us to be very much more positive about the outcome than we wanted to be. So actually, you know, while you're not a politician, it was the politicians that were actually almost having, anecdotally, stand-up fights in the press room with NGOs saying, look, you should be more positive about this. And we're very, very keen. Our head of policy at Christian Aid, Charles Abougré, came into his post in September 2004 and said, right, Johnny, you know, you get going on 2005, I'm concentrating on 2006. And we're very well aware of the need to go on. My question is, you very interestingly spoke about Malawi. You said that changes in trade rules, by which I presume you mean kind of northern access to northern markets, wouldn't make an immediate impact on many poor people in Malawi. Christian Aid is very much coming from that perspective as well. And we're saying that more important than trade access is what we say is enforced liberalisation. In other words, forcing poor countries to open up their markets. And I just wondered if you would agree with that perspective. And maybe a different way of putting it is that Malawi doesn't need necessarily to export. It's not Malawi's ability to export that's key. It's Malawi's ability to produce. And we think that forcing countries to open their markets and compete in an unfair global marketplace at this time is limiting their ability to produce. And that's what we're really, really worried about.
Mm-hmm. Good question. I mean, the whole of the stock force and force liberalisation. And I think we would agree in terms of stock force liberalisation, we do not want to force trade liberalisation on people. I think the counter-argument, because I have a lot of discussions with Christian Aid, and we kind of bat this one backwards and forwards, I think the concern is that long-term, some adjustments will be required in all countries. As trade opens up between different countries, there will be an extent to which countries have to change their trade and their own industries. I mean, if you look at how the UK over the past 50 years or so has changed from being an economy that's been primarily industrial to being a country that is primarily in services. I mean, it's been interesting just seeing Rover recently being kind of the final elements of our mass car industry. And a lot of that is because we were not competitive. We just couldn't make cars cheap enough. We can't compete with some of the low-cost producers. Now, developed countries, we have the financial resources to cope with those kind of trade adjustments. There are some very strong benefits. It means that we no longer have to buy, I better not be rude about Rover cars, but we no longer have to buy certain quality cars when actually we can buy things more cheaply from elsewhere. So there are some very strong benefits to us as consumers. I do believe that trade liberalisation on a wider scale has made things better from a consumer's point of view. The challenge is, however, to make sure that countries can adjust over the length of time that they need to shift their economies around so that when they're not producing something economic, that actually they're able to adjust their economies out of that and into areas where they do have an advantage and they can produce things competitively. And I think it is easier for the richer countries to do that and to put in place the social safety nets than there is for developing countries. And I think, therefore, our argument would be it shouldn't be a case that globalisation and trade liberalisation is bad as such. It can be extremely positive, but it's really important that it's done properly and done well. And by that, I mean that countries are given the support and the time that they need to adjust. In terms of the other thing you talked about, in terms of the poor in Africa and the poor in Malawi, I think the issue there is that having the access into rich markets means nothing if actually you don't have the local capacity to produce. And I think one of the concerns I've had is in the past, trade has been an issue over there, aid has been an issue over there, and you never actually brought the two together and looked at what you need. What we're trying to do is trying to encourage economic growth in developing countries so that they can put in place the social infrastructure and the economy that they need to develop. And the way that you do that is that there has to be aid to support economic growth alongside that. You can't treat the two as isolated. I think the risk is that we view trade as the panacea for all woes, and I think we'd hold our hands up and say we've done that in the past. And I think we need to be clear what trade can do and what it can't do. It cannot solve all the problems for Africa on its own. It actually needs the supply side, the fact building industry, building capacity to go along with that to produce sort of sustainable economic growth.
You've just, in a sense, answered the question I was going to ask, but I do a little bit of work in Rwanda, and, you know, the things that we think about, debt relief, that's important, of course, and we're grateful for that. Trade justice is vital, and all the things that you've just been saying, but Rwanda has no industry, and so to trade with Rwanda is virtually impossible. They need industry, and I was going to say, how can we do what you've just been saying? Build industry, can the government through aid actually encourage industry, which will then be in the hands of individuals who will work for a profit that will then reinvest? Because you haven't got that structure. And so to actually trade, you need to have an infrastructure of investment. Can NGOs do that? I mean, I don't see that And I just wonder how we can enable a country like that, or Malawi is in similar, you know, and things like, for example, they grow coffee and they export the green beans. Somebody else roasts it and make a huge amount of money, and then somebody else packages it and distributes it and makes a huge amount of money. The actual farmer who grows the beans gets very little. I mean, okay, we have fair trade coffee, that's great, but they need the industry to be roasting the beans in Rwanda and exporting roasted beans. And how can we do that?
Good question. I mean, I think the note of caution I have is the danger is that we as Western donors or governments say this is what we should be producing. And you almost get into kind of like a Chinese five-year plan, kind of trying to centrally control things. And actually, I think ultimately it is for developing countries to decide themselves. It's about them actually having a strategy for their own development, and actually them owning that, them doing that in dialogue with their own communities. You know, it's pointless, you know, the government in Kigali saying we are going to produce iron ore if there's no iron. You know, there is a risk where you have to develop. The economists talk about comparative advantage. They're saying, actually, what can this country do? What do we have advantages in? I mean, you look at Africa. They are incredibly rich in minerals. They're incredibly rich in agricultural ability. There is a whole range of advantages that they have that they can make the most of to develop. There are a whole bunch of other issues then that you touched on about ownership in terms of, you know, is it going to be just large corporations, and actually that all the benefit is not going to be seen in that country, but actually all the profits are going to be sucked out and go somewhere else. And I think you then get into very difficult issues about to what extent do you try and manipulate a market and make it a less attractive area. I mean, all this starts opening up some really difficult issues. I think all I would say on this is that, again, it's easy to talk in generalities and say it's easy. It's an awful lot harder when you get into the detail to actually get it right. And I think, sort of coming myself from an evangelical point of view, I think as evangelicals we like things black and white. We like there being good guys and bad guys. We like there being a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do. And I think in a lot of these there are an awful lot of grey areas and complexities. And I think for myself there are times when you just say, Lord, give me some wisdom in this. Because actually, we could do this and this will happen, or we could do this and this will happen, and neither of them are great. What is the right thing to do? And I think the challenge, again, back to churches and Christians generally, is to pray for those who are in positions of decision-making, whether it's politicians, whether it's officials, whether it's in the developed country or in developing countries, and pray, Lord, give them real wisdom.
Okay, Pete, I'm going to come to you now with a slightly more cynical view. You're a civil servant being paid by, you're accountable to the government, who is accountable to me as a taxpayer and as an elector. And as a slightly left-thinking Christian, obviously I agree with what you're saying, but the majority of the people that I know either couldn't care less, and there are some who I think would be completely opposed to what you're doing. It's a waste of time paying your salary. The tax money could be better spent. So my question is, perhaps as a cynic, what is in it for the UK government to be trying to negotiate with third world countries, and then what is in it for the British taxpayer, or is it just because Tony Blair's a nice guy? This is why we're doing it.
It's a good question, and I find it quite interesting that when I talk to NGOs, they kind of have a view that we're all in hock. It's a big business, and big business comes and lobbies us the whole time. It's quite interesting. The arguments that are being made around trade justice are not being made by big business. Big business isn't particularly interested. It's being made around the NGO community, and they're very much setting the agenda. So I think at the heart of it, there is a moral responsibility. There is a moral responsibility. And I think that is very much at the centrepiece of why we are doing it. There is a strong economic argument. There is a strong economic argument why trade liberalisation, and why particularly looking for pro-development trade liberalisation makes sense. Having said that, we're not doing it for that reason. There is a strong economic case. For example, it means that we can get our raw materials that we need for our industries from the most cost-effective sources. It means that we in the UK can source the things that we buy from the most cost-effective source. So, for example, coming back to bra wars for no particular reason, one of the things you're seeing at the moment is clothing prices are coming down for UK consumers because now the limits on Chinese textile exports, who are the most competitive around the world, they're able to sell them in. So there is a strong economic argument. I think there is also a national security and political argument to say, which is actually if you look at the roots of terrorism and where a lot of things have come from, it has been from a sense of injustice. It has been from a sense of failing countries. And one of the largest areas where terrorists are believed to have been coming from is, for example, areas like Somalia and Afghanistan, where there hasn't been any effective government for 10 years or so. So there is a national security argument as well. So those aren't the reasons why we do it. Ultimately, it is because of there is a moral responsibility, but I believe there is a strong economic argument in terms of the benefit to the UK economy. And I believe in terms of UK society, there is also a strong political argument in terms of world stability.
Well, I'm a GP, and part of my job is making people change their mind. I try and stop people smoking, and of course, if I only use the health argument, I don't do very well. But if I encourage them that they won't look so old, if they'll have more money for their holidays, if they will generally have more friends, they're more likely to do it. Should we, non-government organisations, use all the arguments so that politicians can go to other countries and use these same arguments with, say, the Americans, who are probably more interested in less terrorism, etc.? Are we pushing one button all the time?
I would say so, actually. I mean, I think that's been one of my concerns, is that if you keep making the same point again and again and again, that actually it gets devalued. I had a meeting a while back with some of the NGOs, and they raised the same issue, and I said, guys, we've been talking about this for a best part of a year, 18 months. The answer's no, and the answer has been no for the last 18 months. I told you a year ago the answer was no, and this is why. This is why we don't think it's the right route to go down. And I think, therefore, there is an extent to which you do need to develop coherent arguments that don't just say, Tony Blair's a nice guy, it's the right thing to do, but actually make those other arguments. I think particularly when you're talking to other countries that may not share the same value system and the same priorities, that's particularly important. You know, so particularly looking at Africa, the UK has made a big focus on Africa this year, partly because of just you look at the condition of Africa, and there is a very strong moral argument, but also as the UK, we have very strong links to Africa historically. Now, other countries in Europe don't share that focus. They'd be saying, why aren't we doing something for Uzbekistan and the other stands? You know, they've got just as much needs, and that's where I think we have to make different arguments. Having said that, I understand kind of from a campaigner's point of view, you need a simple message. You want to get people engaged. You want to get the most number of people engaged. You have to keep it simple. You have to keep it black and white. You have to keep it good guys, bad guys. But I think the more you engage on these issues, the more influence you have. And I think for individuals who are campaigning on this, my advice to you guys would be develop more arguments. Rosa was going to ask me a question about the extent to which how effective has campaigning, that the NGO campaigning been in terms of UK government position? And the answer is quite mixed. I understand we had 85,000 emails in a fortnight on trade justice. And they had an impact. They said, look, people are concerned about this. But although they just had the same text, and all you had to do is go onto, I think it was a Christian Wade website, type in your details and press click. On the other hand, we had a number of letters that people had written that had got all the arguments. They'd done a bit of research. They'd written to their MP, and their MP had passed this letter to us. And me as an official, I have to draft a letter for the minister. And there are a couple who are right stinking letters. I mean, they were really difficult because these guys had read up about it. They'd researched about it. They'd thought about the arguments. And as a result, there was a lot of head scratching, kind of going, they've got a point here. This is a, you know, this is, we're going to have to think about this hard. And so I think there is kind of the more you invest as campaigners in understanding the issues and campaigning on the issues and putting the different arguments across, the greater impact that you will have than just clicking on a button. And that's not to devalue mass campaigning, but the more you engage on that, and particularly if you have an interest and a passion in it, I would encourage you, research it, start to think about the arguments. Start to think about what the government is saying back and engage in what the counter-argument is, you know, because you'll get a response from us saying, this is why we believe it's good. Engage with that. You know, take it on. So otherwise you will just get the same answer again.
Hello. Just a question on dumping. I think all of us know that the impact of dumping, EU dumping its excess merchandise in Africa has profound implications on people's jobs, livelihoods, economies. Just how seriously is that taken? I haven't heard anything yet about, you know, a plain evil in my book. A plain evil is somehow allowed to happen, and you know, you're one of these people who actually authorized these things. I mean, how do you actually allow something that for me is plainly wrong to be done?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, you look at, I keep saying it's a good question, but the common agricultural policy is unsustainable and very hard to defend. It is a historic legacy. You look at the impact that it is having. It is having a significant impact on particular industries. I mean, I would say it's not across the board, but the whole issue of export subsidies, the whole issue of dumping does have a significant impact and does need to be addressed. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think part of it is there is a political economy issue that for the UK, if you look at the UK economy, agriculture isn't a significant issue for us. If you look at other European economies, agriculture is a much bigger deal for them, and therefore they have much more of an interest. And the negotiations over the common agricultural policy have been extremely difficult and will continue to be so. And we need to continue to press on that. I think the one note of caution I would say, though, is that it is easy to look at developing countries as homogenous and just say it's bad for developing countries. The counter-argument would be actually it's very good for developing country consumers because actually they can buy cheap European, they can buy stuff cheaper. And I think the difficulty will be how do we manage that transition that says when we do away with export subsidies that make goods cheaper, there is a risk that food prices will increase in developing countries. And it's how do we manage that process? If we were to do away with export subsidies now and say they're all gone, actually there is a risk that food prices would increase substantially because there has been the dumping. And it's how do we handle that process? Now, there will long-term be a benefit because domestic agriculture will pick up. But in the short term, there could be quite a price shock and there could have quite an impact. And I think our concern would be, I know the NGOs would give us merry hell if all of a sudden we did away with the common agriculture policy and doubled the food prices in developing countries. So from that point of view, this comes back to some of the complexities. How do we manage that transition?
Last question for me. You mentioned earlier that Rover shut down this year and there were issues with that. This country produces more than 1 million cars a year, so it's not that we can't produce those vehicles. It's about ownership, and you also mentioned in Africa about mineral rights are often owned by other countries' companies. I don't hear enough talk about the role of global corporations and their responsibility in the development of these countries in Africa and Southeast Asia. There's a lot of talk about the responsibility of governments, but when you've got global corporations with turnovers and profits in excess of the income of many of these countries, what is their responsibility in this and how are they being engaged into this?
I mean, you do have to look at corporations. I mean, the particular examples I'm aware of in Africa is that sugar, which looks like being the big issue over the next year in particular, a lot of African production is owned by one company that's a large South African company. Increasing the sugar industry and sugar production in Africa will benefit that corporation. They'll increase their profits, and depending on where the shares are owned, depends on where the benefits of those profits will go back. On the other hand, more people will be employed, and actually for a lot of particularly poor countries, employment is the big step forward away from purely subsistence agriculture and employment. So there is a benefit, but not as much benefit as if all the profits and all the proceeds were going to that bad going back to that country. Some of the large conglomerates have extremely enlightened policies. There is quite a paternalistic approach in some respects that means, so for example, they will provide housing and sanitation and health care for their workers, and that sort of behaviour is to be encouraged. The issue then is do we try and regulate some of these corporations, and does particularly the UK government try and regulate UK-based corporations to make them act in a more socially responsible and ethical way? And I think there certainly is scope for that. But I think any sort of regulation, that there is a risk that if we put the burden too much on corporations within the UK through UK legislation, that they'll just go and set up a bit like a flag of convenience. They'll go and find another country where actually they can get away with blue murder with no accountability. And as long as there's a market for that sort of country, there will be countries where you could get away with that. And so the balance to be struck is how can we lift the boom? How can we lift the level of responsibility and social engagement of large corporations, whilst on the other hand not making it so unattractive for them to invest in African countries, to invest in poor and developing countries, and to be based within the UK and under, therefore, UK legislation. So that's the balancing act that we're trying to hit.
Okay, we have to draw it to a close there. Just want to just remind you that Pete's going to be taking part in the debate at 3:15. And in the meantime, let's just show an appreciation to him for his willingness to come here and put a government point of view.
Thank you very much. Thank you.